available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Welcome to Outlook. My name is Peter Walters, and this edition is being recorded on the 11th of February 2026. Coming up in the programme, we're looking at National Trust pubs. It's Pancake Week. Dave and Graham Monks are going railwaying near Bedford. All that and much more. We're wandering down Warwickshire Way at Prior's Marston Village, south of Southam. All that, as I say, and much more with a sport and a postbag as well. But first of all, it's the news, read by our readers Peter and Elaine.
Outlook News.
The Godiva Festival will not take place this year after organisers revealed the Coventry Music Weekender would be put on pause and replaced by a programme of summer events in the city centre. Coventry City Council said the War Memorial Park Festival, which has been running for over 25 years, has been cancelled for 2026 due to rising costs and industry challenges affecting festivals across the UK. The head of events at Coventry City Council said, "It's not all over, as Godiva Festival is set to be replaced with a free city centre event over financial issues." John Hogan said residents could still keep the spirit of the three-day annual festival alive, and the council announced its plans to pause the event. Mr. Hogan said on Monday, "Staging large mass gatherings is an expensive enterprise. We cover some of that cost with council budget. We also cover it through admissions and commissions on food and drink, as well as sponsorship. But when we don't sell as many tickets as we would have hoped, that leaves a big gap. It's a risk when you're dealing with public money, and it's something you need to mitigate." He added that audience numbers had dropped in the last 2 years, with customer feedback surveys putting ticket costs as the biggest reason why. "It's a rise of cost and declining audience, and it's an audience that doesn't have deep pockets." Speaking of the costs involved, he said the price of artists, medics on site and even security staff had risen. But this news was warmly welcomed with barks of delight from the Fox family, who live in the den in the woods on the Kenilworth Road. They had raised a petition supported with hundreds of paw prints expressing concern about this annual event, which causes disruption to their nightlife and shatters their eardrums. This petition was taken by snail mail to the pigeon post tree and then flown to the local councillor with responsibility for urban foxes.
In place of the Godiva Festival this year, the council have announced a new and exciting programme of summer events which will be delivered in Coventry City Centre, offering music, culture and creative celebration. That programme will be centred around Godiva in the City, a two-day event on Saturday the 4th and Sunday the 5th of July, showcasing local musicians and creative talent. Other free and low-cost events will focus on culture, sport and Coventry's heritage to support the city's creative sectors and represent its values and heritage. Councillor Abdul Salam Khan, Deputy Leader of Coventry City Council, said, "While the festival will not take place this year, our support for Coventry's creative sector and community events continues. We'd like to thank everyone who's supported Godiva Festival over the years, and we remain committed to supporting local music and creative talent. Our programme of exciting, free and low-cost city centre events this year will be taking place for residents to enjoy, and we can't wait to tell you more about our plans. More details about the summer events programme will be released over the coming months."
A winning project has been praised for helping to get underrepresented Coventry communities involved in sport. Councillor Naeem Akhtar, Cabinet Member for Housing and Communities at the Council, visited the volunteer-led Coventry Sports Cohesion Project as it held a session in Hillfields to encourage ethnic minority groups to get into sport. The scheme is particularly targeted at people living in deprived areas such as Hillfields and Foleshill, which has a dense population of ethnic minorities. Since its launch in 2021, the organisation has seen great success in young people's development and ability, with parents reporting greater satisfaction and plans to continue to encourage more people to get involved. Councillor Akhtar said, "It was a pleasure to support some of the bright and talented young people in our city. We must recognise and highlight the importance of sports in our communities as a way to support young people's development and well-being in our communities, bridging the gap for those who are disadvantaged so that equal opportunities are made available for all young people."
Continuing the sports-related theme, Coventry Speedway campaigners are now hopeful that the sport can return soon to the area after a 10-year absence. Brandon Stadium was shut in 2016 when Coventry Bees stopped racing at the stadium after failing to reach a deal to continue there. The stadium's owners, Brandon Estates, had previously planned to build 124 homes and a football pitch with a pavilion on the site off Rugby Road, but plans to demolish the circuit for housing were rejected in January 2024. Last year, Rugby Borough Council submitted a proposal as part of its local plan to support the restoration of Brandon Stadium for speedway or for stock car racing, as well as other motorsports and community uses. Jeff Davis, chairman of Save Coventry Speedway and Coventry Stocks, said that if the plan was approved by inspectors and adopted, there could finally be light at the end of the tunnel. "The recent boost is the Rugby Council approval of the local plan, and in that plan there's a policy which specifically states Rugby Council support the reinstatement of Brandon Stadium and speedway racing," he said. "And any planning application submitted will not be considered if it is contrary to that, so it would be multi-purpose." He said the group was lobbying people to write in to support the plan, which is currently in a six-week consultation phase before being submitted to national inspectors, followed by a public hearing. The group is hoping that people will rally together to support the plan. Mr. Davis added, "What we're doing now is lobbying people to write in. They have to send an email to send in support. We hope thousands of people will do it. Already in just 4 or 5 days, 700 people have done so, and we're asking people to do it by the end of February. I'm becoming very optimistic."
Any improvement in the bus service in Coventry could take years, according to the person in charge of bus reform at the West Midlands Combined Authority. Natalie Penrose told a meeting at Coventry City Council that when Transport for West Midlands, the public transport section of the West Midlands Combined Authority, takes over, very little would change on the first day of the new organisation. "That is because we need a smooth transition so that people can still get the buses so that they can get where they need to be." The WMCA voted last May to bring buses back under public control under Labour Mayor Richard Parker's franchising system. Natalie Penrose told a meeting of the Business, Economy and Enterprise Scrutiny Board at the council, "The operator which wins the franchise will have access to the Coventry depot for the duration of the deal. We will give time-defined contracts to bus operators, so we won't have the monopoly that we have at the moment with National Express. We will have control of the depots and control of the fleet of buses." She added Coventry would be included in the first round of franchises when the new system comes into force in October 2027. However, she told the meeting, expectations about immediate change would need to be managed. "The opportunity to change the network and put things back will come later. After that date in October, we can start talking to people about what they want to see with improvements. I know that sounds like a long way away, and it isn't what you want to hear, but I need to be clear that we are looking for a smooth transition and not a changed network."
Coventry Hospital Radio has been shortlisted for this year's National Hospital Broadcasting Awards. The station has been shortlisted for the Best Station Promotion Award for its on-air promotions, which invite music requests from listeners. Simon Tidmarsh, PR officer, said, "We are delighted that we've been nominated in Best Station Promotion this year. Coventry Hospital Radio prides itself in playing your choice, your music, and in giving the listeners a chance to hear their favourite songs on the radio while either recovering here at UHCW in Coventry or from home. I would also like to add a big thank you to all our volunteers who give up their free time every week to keep the radio station going and to keep patients entertained while they are in hospital." At last year's awards, the station finished in the top 10 in the 5 categories in which it was shortlisted, including Station of the Year. This year's awards ceremony will take place on the 21st of March in Bolton, celebrating exceptional standards demonstrated by hospital radio stations across the country, and also celebrating 100 years of hospital radio. Coventry Hospital Radio broadcasts for free, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, inside the University Hospital of Coventry and Warwickshire NHS Trust, online at www.coventryhospitalradio.org, or on the Coventry Hospital Radio app, as well as on your smart speakers.
A Warwick businesswoman will be the guest speaker at an event to mark International Women's Day. Indu Seshadri is the co-founder and director of SKEWB, spelt S-K-E-W-B, SKEWB, which delivers specialist digital products for organisations across the gas, water, power and wider infrastructure sectors. She will be speaking at the Coventry and Warwickshire Chamber of Commerce's Women in Business event at Walton Hall Hotel on Friday the 6th of March between 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. The event also marks International Women's Day, which falls 2 days later. Ms. Shadri said, "International Women's Day is a reminder of the power we hold when we lift each other up. Give to gain reflects something I deeply believe. When we share our knowledge, our time and our support, we strengthen our whole community. I'm honoured to speak at this event and to celebrate the incredible women driving change across Coventry and Warwickshire." Julie McGarrigal, director of Osters Kelly Solicitors, added, "We are delighted to be a sponsor of this event. As a local business where 3 out of 4 directors are female and 87% of our workforce are women, we are very passionate about supporting them and giving them more confidence to flourish and achieve in whatever they choose to do."
And now something following on from what Hugh spoke of last week. Offering prostate cancer tests only to men with a confirmed genetic marker for it leaves black men at greater risk, a man diagnosed with the disease has said. Guy Griffiths from Coventry was diagnosed after he requested a prostate-specific antigen, that's a PSA test, from his GP in 2024. Mr. Griffiths said black men were vulnerable but overlooked and must demand that they get tested regardless of the existing recommendations from the UK National Screening Committee. This committee has said that only men with specific genetic mutations that lead to more aggressive tumours should be eligible for testing. This, however, can rule out black men who have double the risk and men who have the disease running through their families. Prostate cancer is the most prevalent form of the disease for all men, with 56,000 cases diagnosed every year. The charity, Prostate Cancer UK, suggests that while 1 in 8 men will develop the disease during their lifetime, the rate rises to 1 in 4 for black men. Keith Morgan, Associate Director of Black Health Equity at Prostate Cancer UK, said that there's absolutely no evidence to suggest that racism was involved, but what I would say is that it's inconsistency. So some men like Guy, who are very proactive, they're able to detect prostate cancer early, which means they're more likely to receive treatment that can cure it. What about men who don't have that understanding? That's why we're investing so much in our risk awareness campaign to try and get men, particularly those with the highest risk of prostate cancer, to understand that the level of risk is so sufficient that they can speak to their GP. Mr. Griffith's PSA result in 2024 meant he had an MRI scan and a biopsy that December, which showed he'd the most aggressive form, but he's undergoing a trial treatment under which he will receive 5 sessions of radiotherapy over a 2-week period. And he added that his latest PSA reading was 0, indicating that he has a really good chance of beating the disease.
Proposals to redesign a major junction on the A46 have been approved by the Department for Transport. The project for the Walsgrave Junction, east of Coventry, will cost over £112 million and should take 2 years to complete. The government has approved a development consent order for the project, which is part of the Trans Midlands Trade Corridor between the M5 and Humber ports. At present, the junction which connects the A46 to the B4082 is a roundabout with 3 entries and exits, which National Highways states creates a bottleneck and congestion for traffic heading both east and west. Under the redesign, a flyover would be installed, allowing traffic to flow more freely, while vehicles would leave or join the A46 via 2 new roundabouts. National Highways Project Manager Emma Winter said, "The A46 is a major trade corridor between the South West, Midlands and the North, which is why we need to remove this bottleneck. The new look Walsgrave Junction will reduce delays by delivering much needed additional capacity, better connectivity and safer journeys for the 57,000 drivers using the road every day. Work is expected to start in late 2026, with the redesigned junction fully open to traffic in 2028. A traffic management proposal for the duration of the work has outlined narrowed lanes, a temporary speed limit reduction to 40 miles per hour, and occasional road closures. James Barwise, the policy lead for the Road Haulage Association, said, "The A46 is a vital strategic road. Schemes such as this are critical to ensure this route supports the frictionless movement of goods and unlocks economic growth for businesses across the Midlands."
Change could also be coming to Coventry's fire service, as bosses say that it needs to look at how services are delivered. West Midlands Fire Service has launched a consultation into how it responds to emergencies. It says there's been no major change in more than a decade, and Chief Fire Officer Simon Toohill says the time is now right to review how it serves its communities, including Coventry. This could lead to some changes. It's no secret there's already been some change to the service across the city. About 2 years ago, a pump rescue ladder, which is used in both firefighting and rescue operations, was removed from Coventry Fire Station, and there was a brigade response vehicle brought into the city. Locals are being asked to have their say in an online consultation, which allows people to share specific suggestions about the local service. In a statement, Chief Fire Officer Toohill said, "West Midlands Fire Service has been serving our communities for over 50 years, yet our operating model has stayed broadly the same for more than a decade. We need to explore how we can remain effective, trusted and be there when people need us. Several of our sites need major investment if we are to deliver the levels of service our communities expect. They need to be accessible and safe for staff and visitors alike, with proper training and welfare facilities. The types of emergencies and risks for which we need to be prepared are also changing, from climate change and flooding through to people living longer and some becoming more vulnerable. Our current model has to change in order to meet these new complexities." Chief Fire Officer Toohill concluded, "We're proud to reach the most serious incidents within 5 minutes, and we know that increases someone's chances of survival. Our analysis shows that by altering the number of our stations to match risk and demand, we could maintain that standard and invest more in those stations that we keep. However, no decisions have been made. This initial round of consultation is a chance for our communities to help us reimagine how we could operate while keeping response times and public safety front and centre.
Wildflowers, vegetables and fruit trees could be planted on disused council land after councillors gave their backing to a project they heard will also encourage wildlife. The move follows a cross-party motion at Coventry City Council back in December. Rhianne Palmer, the council's Green Futures strategic lead, explained that the Community Growing Sites scheme aim to support residents and community groups to take ownership of their local environment through maintaining and improving disused or underutilised areas for the benefit of the local community. In her report that will be considered by a cabinet meeting this week, she said, "This is a brilliant opportunity to help tackle inequalities in access to green space across the city and provides a new opportunity to bring people and communities together. Proposed planting could be wildflowers, native plants or fruit trees. This could include planting areas of grass on streets, taking on plots of land for food growing and nature gardens, using council-owned planters as well as potentially planting orchards and hedgerows in some of our parks and open spaces. A policy and process will be in place to provide guidance and to support communities to ensure what is planted is appropriate for the location, which will include consultation with nearby residents." Speaking to councillors at a recent scrutiny coordination committee, she added, "This is a new policy. There are not many places across England that do this. Hull set up the first a few years ago, and we are learning from what they have done, as we want to ensure that this is managed in the right way. We are also keen to use non-council land, so Citizen and I know the Canal and River Trust are also interested, which would be very handy for canal boat owners. So we are keen to try and reach out to other landowners who have bits of land not doing anything." Councillor Rupinder Singh raised a concern about ensuring leases were only handed to legitimate people. He said, "We need to be watertight and explain that this land is for growing and for Coventry residents only. We need to be clear that it is to increase the biodiversity, no other purpose. I need those assurances." Ms. Palmer said, "The lease template that has been drafted is very clear, and the sites will be inspected to make sure they are being used as agreed. If not, then the lease will be terminated early. We have that control. It will be managed really robustly."
Sydney Springer Primary Academy has become the first school in Coventry to be rated under the new Ofsted system. Ofsted inspections and reports have undergone a huge overhaul. Single word overall grades such as outstanding or inadequate have been scrapped in favour of fuller and fairer judgments. Ofsted now uses a report card system, handing out grades across a range of areas, and it's hoped that this approach will give parents a broader picture. Schools and other education settings are now rated on achievement, attendance and behaviour, curriculum and teaching, inclusion, leadership and governance, personal development and well-being, plus, where relevant, post-16 provisions and early years provisions. They can be marked in each of these areas as exceptional, strong standard, expected standard, needs attention, or urgent improvement. In Coventry, Sydney Stringer was the first to be rated under the new system. It was inspected last November and the report has now been published. It's good news, with a strong standard achieved in all of the relevant areas. Inspectors said, Sydney Stringer Primary Academy is an inclusive school where pupils flourish. They receive an excellent start to their education. There is a collective vision to ensure that pupils believe, achieve and succeed. One parent's comment captured this well. This school is totally focused on the children. Staff at the school have high expectations. Pupils live up to these expectations in all aspects of school life. This is reflected in the very positive outcomes that they achieve by the time they leave the school. And this is especially the case for disadvantaged pupils. At every stage, pupils are very well prepared for their next steps and they love coming to school to learn.
And our last news item is a success story with a happy ending, but from the other side of the world. We got lost out there. 13-year-old Austin Appleby tells the emergency operator, after swimming 4 kilometres in the rough open ocean and running 2 kilometres to save his family. The operator asks how long it is since he set off. It was a very long time ago. I think they're kilometres out to sea. I think we need a helicopter to go find them, he says. Western Australian police have released the phone call Austin made last month after he left his family drifting at sea off the coast to get help. His voice is clear and calm, even as he details his concern for his family. I don't know what their condition is right now, and I'm really scared, he tells the operator. Mum just said, go, get help. We were in massive trouble. The family was on holiday in Guindaloupe, 200 kilometres south of Perth. They set off from Geograph Bay some time after 10 a.m. on Friday the 30th of January. They had been swept 4 kilometres out to sea in rough conditions while kayaking and paddleboarding. His mum asked him to take his kayak and find help. So Austin started out, ditching first his sinking craft and then his cumbersome life jacket to swim the distance. After reaching land 4 hours later, he ran for 2 kilometres to get to his mother's phone. Hello, he said. My name is Austin. I have 2 siblings, Beau and Grace. Beau is 12 and Grace is 8. I'm sitting on the beach right now. And I have to also explain, I think I need an ambulance because I am very disorientated. Joanne Appleby, Austin's mother, told the BBC they were playing around when the kids went out a bit too far. The wind picked up, they lost their oars and started drifting. It kind of all went wrong very, very quickly, she said. And then she had to make one of the hardest decisions to send her eldest son to swim ashore to get help. I knew he was the strongest and he could do it, she says. Austin described feeling very puffed out. I just keep swimming. I do breaststroke, I do freestyle, I do survival backstroke, he says. He called the emergency services at about 6 p.m. At about 8:30 p.m., 10 hours after they first set out, the Applebys were spotted and rescued. They had floated about 14 kilometres out to sea.
Outlook News.
Thanks to our readers, Peter and Elaine. Before moving on, I'll just give some lighting up times this week. They are from 5:11 p.m., 11 minutes past 5 in the evening, to 7:31 a.m. in the morning. One other item I've got here, actually, before we move on. I'm not sure whether Hugh was going to say anything about this, but I was given a bit of paper talking about the sale at the charity shop. Next door?
No, I wasn't.
Right, okay. Well, this week's sale, I think they did DVDs last week, is on books. And hardbacks are £2 for £1, and paperbacks are £3 for £1. So get your books next door at the shop. Right, Hugh's here with plenty of news. Here we go.
I am not here with plenty of news. I am here. There's no doubt about it. But I don't have a vast amount of news this week. But that's I wasn't planning to be here this week. I was supposed to be in Nottingham for a meeting, but it got cancelled. First off, I mentioned last week about Gary Kennedy, who sadly has died. His funeral, I told you, was taking place on the 24th of February. That is still the case. The good news, in as much as there is good news about this, is that it will be in Coventry. So those of us who are able to will be going to his funeral. Now, we don't know at the moment whether it's morning or afternoon or what time it is exactly. Anyway, we'll try and keep you updated on that. But if anybody would like to go to Gary's funeral on the 24th at whatever time it is, I will certainly be going, and a couple of other people from the allotment group will be going. So if you fancy going, then there will certainly be a way of getting you there if you fancy it. So do let everybody know at reception. If you would like that, the number to call for that, all as always, is 024 7671 7522. We cancelled the exercise group on Wednesdays for this week. We're actually going to cancel it forever, I'm afraid. We just haven't had enough people who want to take part. It's a lot more sort of physical exercise than in our other exercise activities, and we just haven't been able to get enough people to make that a going concern. So I'm afraid that the physical exercise group that has been on Wednesdays, I'm afraid, is no longer. We will be looking at other activities. Not necessarily physical activities, but you know, we're always looking to try new things and see if they stick and hold. And some of them do, and some of them don't. But we will have more activities coming for you at some point in the not too distant future. One of them I'd like to talk to you about, actually, is to sort of gauge a measure of interest in a mindfulness group. This is sort of like meditation, but it's thinking about things seriously, I suppose, and being in the moment and present. We've had an approach from somebody who is a qualified practitioner of mindfulness, so I would be very grateful to know if that is something that you might be interested in. It would be like an hour-long session, and yeah, sort of, I suppose, based around meditation and other things. I think it might be a very good group, and I think there might be a lot of people out there who might be interested in it. We have a lot of watches. We had a bit of a splurge. We had no watches, really, talking watches available, and now we've got lots. So if your talking watch is a bit past its sell-by date, or you just fancy a new one, they range from about 30-odd quid to about 50-odd quid. But they're very good, and they're in for talking to you, and quite easy to operate. Now, it is that season of the year, isn't it, when people are getting all crook and everything? No, it's not pancakes. It's germs and respiratory diseases and all sorts of things like that. So is the plea to you out there, if you are ill, if you're coughing and spluttering, please make the decision not to come in, because there's a lot of people here who are vulnerable, and so we don't really want to spread it around. You know, touch wood, he says, banging his head. You know, we haven't had any sort of major outbreaks of anything nasty in the lurgy department for a while. I would like to keep that record going. Next week I'm definitely not here because I'm having the week off, so if you need anything, you'll just have to wait. Well, from me, I would suggest talking to any of my most excellent colleagues, and they will help you out with almost anything that you need. And that is it. That's all I've got for you this week, which is not very much.
It's enough anyway. Thank you. And now it's time for Sarah with this week's sport. And she starts by apologising for the noise on her recordings. The buildings were in next door, apparently. The builders, I should say, were in next door, apparently.
Well, hello there, lovely, lovely listeners, and welcome to sport. Now, as usual, I'm going to start off with football, but I promise it will improve after that. Honest, yeah. Well, on Saturday, Coventry had a home match after losing their last two matches, both of which were away. And they were taking on the might of Oxford United, who are currently 23rd of 24 teams in the division and pretty much set sure for relegation this season. To make it even better for Coventry, with about 20 minutes left, Oxford had a man sent off. Yeah, the final score, 0-0. And I assure you, everyone, that is 90 minutes of my life I shall never get back. It was boring, it was frustrating. And you just wonder where Coventry are going to go now, to be honest, this season. This season promised so much. Well, we are still top of the league, but you're not getting the song. Because we are only top by 1 point. And that is only because, or you could say it's helped by, the fact that Middlesbrough, who are second, play on Monday night. So they can leapfrog us now if they win and beat Sheffield United. Anyway, who's our next match against? Middlesbrough at the CBS on Monday at 8 p.m. Well, I hope it's more inspiring than that one on Saturday. That's all I can say. So, going down to the non-league clubs, now a lot of these matches were actually called off because of waterlogged pitches. Can't understand why anyone would think it had rained a lot recently. Well, those matches actually included Stratford Town and Rugby Borough Women, which was a shame for Rugby Borough because they were due to take on Wolverhampton Wanderers in a second place third match in their league, which is the third tier of women's football. Anyway, one escaping the flood was Leamington Town, who took on Oxford City. A lot of Oxfords come into our area. Gosh, that train must have been crowded in the morning. Anyway, just like their bigger counterparts playing an Oxford club, they also drew. But for Leamington, that was a good result because you may remember they have not been doing very well and are currently rock bottom of their league. Now, before I move on to rugby, I just want to say a huge congratulations to my little teeny Coventry United. They have made the quarterfinals of the FA Vars. Now, you might be thinking, FA Vars, that doesn't sound a major competition. Well, no, it's not a huge competition like the FA Cup, but it is one that tier 9, 8, 7 and 6 clubs take part in. And Little Coventry United are in tier 9. Anyway, they got to the quarterfinals by beating North Shields 2-1. Now, moving on to change of ball with rugby, but staying local, Coventry were away to the champ leaders, Ealing Trailfinders. Trailfinders not only won the championship, as it was called last year, but are currently way ahead at the top and in fact haven't lost a single game this season. Now, at half time, that all looked set to change, but I'm afraid, like last week, Coventry ended up on the wrong side of a 36-34 score line. However, their 34 points did mean that they got 3 bonus points, which has seen them leapfrog over Chinner, who they played last week, and they are now 5th in the champ. And on the national front, you may remember that the Six Nations were starting. You didn't? Well, I've given you enough warning. Anyway, France playing in Paris massacred Ireland. Italy playing in Rome squeaked a victory past Scotland. Could this carry on? Would it be the home rule? No. England travelled to the Millennium Stadium in Wales, and I'm delighted to say came back with a 48-7 victory. So while the Welsh Dragon is lying on the pitch looking very injured, the English Chariot is sure swinging very sweet and very low. So what happened to Mia Brooks on her flying skateboard? Well, snowboard. Well, she had an exact repeat performance, I'm afraid, of Kirsty, and finished a very creditable but 4th place. In her last jump, she tried to compete with a world-breaking jump, and unfortunately, she didn't land it. But then again, we got Jen and Bruce. They'd had 7 wins out of 8 in the qualifiers. Surely they could beat the pesky Scandinavians of Sweden. Well, I'm afraid they couldn't. In fact, they never led. They once got equal, but they never led. And so they will face either America, well, the US, or Italy, and I believe it's more likely to be Italy, in the playoffs for the bronze, or like last year, the nothing. Never mind, we've got the silly people sliding down on their tea trays. Oh, and by the way, while I remember, I found out the difference between the luge and the skeleton. The luge, you go down on your back with your neck at the back of the tea trolley up at a silly angle so you can look through your feet to find out where you're going. And the skeleton, well, you just go down head first and hope that it all ends well. So I look forward next week to bringing you more dizzy tales of the Winter Olympics. So what have I been doing with my life since I spoke to you last week? Well, I have to say a lot of it has been spent sitting on my sofa watching the Winter Olympics. Well, I am still in rehab. I have to say, well, I don't have to, but I'm going to. That opening ceremony was one of the best Olympic ceremonies I have ever seen, leaving London aside, of course. It was spectacular for both audio and visual. Now, there were actually 2 ceremonies going on simultaneously, and it was very well coordinated. The main ceremony was in Milan, and then there was a slightly smaller ceremony in Cortina, where most of the skiing events are. Highlights for me included amazing singing of rendition of Nessun Dorma by Andrea Bocelli, the famous Italian tenor. And I suppose you have to say Mariah Carey. Well, it proves that Mariah is more than just for Christmas anyway. That is taken straight from the BBC. Yes, I have lifted it, folks. And then when the famous Chinese pianist Lan Lan accompanied an Italian soprano singing the Olympic anthem, I'm afraid that was my cue for the tears to just flow. Anyway, what about the competition? Well, we knew that Saturday and Sunday weren't going to deliver anything for Great Britain. I mean, we had a 10th in the ski cross country, which was very credible. But Monday dawned and great things were expected or forecast. Could Kirsty Wade deliver in, well, what is basically downhill skiing with a lot of ramps that you throw yourself off and do tricks and back somersaults and twists? Could Mia Brooks deliver in the skate, in the snowboarding big air, as it's called, which is basically like skateboarding where you throw yourself off a huge ramp and do, again, lots of somersaults and twists? And could the perennial Jen and Bruce, sorry, I don't know their surnames, deliver? Well, they wouldn't deliver a gold or silver today, but if they won their semi-final, they would be into the final and sure of a gold or silver. Well, I'm afraid the first of four was Kirsty Wade. She did very well, don't underestimate that. She lost out on a bronze medal and came fourth by 0.41 of a mark. That must be so frustrating. Christine, at this point, insert the bit that I will be sending you later. And finally, have you heard the one about the England cricket team? Well, it is the men's T20 World Championship at the moment, and I was channel flicking on the radio and telly on Sunday in search of sport that I wanted to watch or listen to, and I came across the cricket, which I realised was drawing to a conclusion, when I heard the commentator say, well, England's opponents need 45 runs off 19 balls, so it's very unlikely. But gradually the 45 runs went to 39, and so it went down until it got to the squeaky bum syndrome amount of 10 runs off 5 balls. I sort of walked up and down with my Zimmer frame, clenching my teeth, doing everything possible. And we won by 4 runs. And the cricket mighty country we were up against, was it Australia, New Zealand, Pakistan, India? No, Nepal. I didn't even know that Nepal had a cricket team. Certainly never heard of them, and I believe it's the first time England have ever played them, and I'm sure they don't want to play them again. Anyway, lovely listeners, that has been your sport for this week. Don't have nightmares. Bye.
Thanks to Sarah for the sport. Here's Dave Monks with Postbag.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello, welcome to your Postbag. Just recently I asked you what you thought about Postbag, following me telling you about my eldest son Paul asking blind comedian Chris McCausland what he thought of talking newspapers. He replied by saying they're all right for elderly people who haven't yet got the hang of new technology. I asked you what you thought of Postbag. This is Graham's reply.
Well, Dave Monks asked what we thought of Postbag, or what we thought ought to go into it or something. I can't remember the exact terminology now. But I do fear for the future of Postbag. We have Edwina's advice corner and Julie's piece every week, diary piece every week, I can't remember what you call it now, and occasionally Dave will twist somebody's arm at the Monday Club to say something into his machine. but most of Postbag these days seems to be staged, S-T-A-G-E-D. There's very little spontaneous discussion. Very few people make comments on things which have gone out on the magazine, or perhaps response to something somebody has said in Postbag. I do occasionally, but very rarely you hear anybody else do it. I suppose it needs somebody like a Jim Smallman or Dave Nichols, somebody controversial like that, who was inclined to ruffle people's feathers occasionally, but at least it did get a response from the listenership. But I think the problem with Postbag is a far wider one, actually. And I would be interested to know how many people actually receive the magazine today compared with 20 years ago. And I'm not going on about the difference between memory sticks and cassettes, but how many people receive hard copy today than 20 years ago? I know some people listen on the internet. It's a comforting thought to think that people are listening on the internet. But how many are doing so? How many people are listening to Outlook through the various forms which they can listen it to, and also the hard copy together, compared with the people who listened 20 years ago? I bet you there is a big difference. Okay? Right, now if that doesn't get any response, then I might as well give up.
Well, the future of Postbag is in your hands. I do share your fears, Graham, but I also believe, like Mr. Micawber in Charles Dickens' David Copperfield, that something will turn up, or someone, because I have some lovely surprises in Postbag when people pop up and say something. Outlook is very rare in talking newspapers, in having a spot where visually impaired people can express themselves. As far as the amount of listeners is concerned, at one time most people had a cassette player or radio cassette player, so we had more listeners then. Now, one of the many celebrity guests in Postbag, former Blind Home Secretary David Blunkett, spoke to you in praise of cassettes. As regard to Postbag being staged, I spend hours arranging the Postbag messages, like music, like you do, with one comment flowing into the next, with a big start, interesting middle and big finish. But I do need your messages. I like to put on a good show, like my granddad did when he staged a grand concert in a Victorian Sunday school in Sheffield on the 30th of November 1908. Now, he must have twisted a few arms of friends and relatives to take part in the charity show, judging by the names on the bill. Users at Coventry Vision Hub know I carry a little recording machine round with me, and tell me they would like to record a message, and other people I ask, particularly before Christmas, as it's important to cheer people up at what can be the loneliest time of the year for some people. I get invited by Edwina to come round and record little tips from her in Postbag. Being deafblind, she can feel very isolated, and Postbag gives her an opportunity to reach out from her four walls and communicate with you, which is very important for her and us. Julia, for a long time, did a weekly report at her talented English stroke computer teacher's John England's house, who used to spice up her reports, and they both did a fantastic job. So get well soon, John. Without Julia's reports, you wouldn't know about VISTA, the Visually Impaired and Sighted Tandem Association, that gives visually impaired people the freedom of the open road. During the winter months, they have social events that Julia also reports on, that you don't have to be a tandem rider to go on. Or the Torch Fellowship, a gentle Christian group that meets on the last Saturday of the month at Earlston Methodist Church from 2 to 4pm. I may record many of the Postbag messages myself, but that makes the sound quality of them so good. So thank you if you make the effort to keep Postbag going and make it interesting. So please follow their example. Without you, there will be no Postbag, despite my efforts. So going back to where the Postbag is staged, well, all the world's a stage, and we are merely players. And that leads me nicely on to a report by Elizabeth on a film she went to see about Shakespeare's son called Hamnet, who died aged 11. Here's Elizabeth.
Hi, everyone. The Roving Report. This week we saw a brilliant film, Hamnet, a cinematic masterpiece. This film will take all the plaudits for 2026. Paul Mescal played William Shakespeare. Jessie Buckley was his wife, Anne Hathaway. This was filmed around Hereford and the River Wye. The stunning village of Wobley became medieval Stratford-upon-Avon. Anne had three children. Her daughter Susanna married a Dr. Hall. They had one child, Elizabeth, who sadly had no children. The second daughter, Judith, had three sons who all died young. Shakespeare, who was born in 1564 and died in 1616, is universally recognised as the greatest English writer. His father was a tradesman who became mayor of Stratford in 1586. Shakespeare's young son, Hamnet, died at only 11 years old, which inspired him to write his tragedy, Hamlet. He was in the leading theatrical company, the Lord Chamberlain's Men. They became known as the King's Men in 1603. In 1597, he bought New Place, a large house in Stratford. He later became a shareholder in the Globe Theatre, London. His final experimental plays, The Winter's Tale in 1610 and The Tempest in 1611, were written for the educated audiences of the indoor theatre at Blackfriars, which the King's Men had acquired in 1608. His first 36 plays were published in 1623.
Thank you, Elizabeth, for that great report. Most of that information didn't come from the film, that was largely fiction. It came from her recent research following the film. So well done, Elizabeth. Robert Franklin tells me about the end of the pier show that happened to his favourite seaside resort, that he goes to on his own by train with the help of Journey Care, which is talked about in Postbag and just recently on R&IB Connect Radio. Due to the storm, the end of the Tynemouth Pier was destroyed. It was built in 1867. The huge waves crashed onto the seawall, forcing closure of the railway line that runs along the side of the prom. And from real-life drama to fictional drama, we hear from Graham Whale, this time about the crime books he's read.
Yes, I want to correct something first of all. I did suggest that the chief constable was involved with a cult, or the circle as they refer to it. And only the reader knew about it so far. Actual fact, it's Chief Superintendent Gregor, who was involved with the circle. And it is starting to come to light now in the third book of the series. How they managed to keep the theme running through the whole series, I don't know. But I look forward to reading them all eventually. But I am surprised that they're not on talking book, actually. They're just starting to print them in Braille. I'm in the third of the series. And I'm surprised there aren't some of them with the talking book library. I also enjoy Peter Banks' Peter Robbins' Banks stories. And also the American author James Pattison. I've read just about everything he's written, including his children's books, which I've read for artistic reasons, of course. But crime fiction is my thing. That's what I like to read. So there we go. Oh yes, I've also read some Geoffrey Archer books, his Warwick books. I've always kept away from these books, simply the fact I don't like Geoffrey Archer. And I don't know why, what made me read the first one, but I've read two of his books now, and I quite enjoy them. Anyway, as I say, crime fiction is my forte.
Thank you, Graham. Tell us about the books that you like reading. A crime writer called Lee Child said hello to you in Postbag and told you about some former blind radio operators that were in the Marines, who had become blind, who read his books in Morse code. I was impressed by that piece of information. Were you? Okay, finally, can you speak Italian? If so, can you interpret what this lovely Italian waitress said to me after I serenaded her? She was working as a waitress in a cocktail bar or something like that. Here we are. David and Eleanor, save your love, my darling, save your love, for summer nights and moon and stars above. A serenade I long to sing you, the reddest rose I long to bring you, save your love for Roma and for me.
Save your love for Roma and for me.
Oh, beautiful, thank you, Eleanor. Thank
you. Benissimo, grazie David per l'esperienza.
Yeah, thank you. So, can you translate Eleanor's words for me, please? Nigel asked you to tell us about your school days and school outings you went on. I went on a school outing to the Tower of London, where I saw the first man in space, Yuri Gagarin. What's your memories? Well, it's over to you now. Postbag and its future is in your hands. You can phone that number, ring Coventry Vision Hub on 024 76 717 522 and press 5 for Coventry Talking Newspaper and start speaking. You can write a letter, you can send an email, you can send me one if you like, davidmonks46@gmail.com. And there is an official Postbag email called postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. And you can write a letter written by you or someone on your behalf. There's loads of ways you can talk to us, but it's very important. Okay, thank you for your messages this week. Please let's hear from you next time. Bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
And that's all from Postbag for this week. Thanks to Dave, as usual. Wandering down Warwickshire Way this week takes us to the village of Priors Marston, 6 miles south of Southam. Once owned by the Benedictines of St Mary's Priory in Coventry, the Marston part of its name references a fishing lake, once managed by the monks.
In the south-east of the county of Warwickshire, we find the village of Priors Marston. Set at the side of a ridge which forms the edge of the Northamptonshire uplands, with fine views to the west and the Malvern Hills in the distance, and on a very clear day one can see as far as the Cambrian Mountains. The name Priors Marston is from the Anglo-Saxon merse, meaning marsh, with turn, meaning town, or in this case, village. The Priors was added by the monks of the Benedictine Priory of Coventry, after the manor was endowed to them, with 23 others by Earl Leofric in 1043. It is mentioned in the Domesday Book of 1086 as part of Prior's Hardwick, the next parish, but by 1236 was listed on the Prior's Terriers as a separate place. However, a settlement was undoubtedly in existence many generations before these dates. It is set on the very ancient Ridgeway track with the Jurassic Way nearby. Prior's Marston is also situated on the Droitwich to Northampton Salt Road, mentioned in 956, along which salt was carried for tanning and meat preservation. The Welsh Drovers Road also enters the parish. This runs from the Welsh borders through to Barnet, near London. A high constable was stationed here to deter highwaymen, as one of the main coaching routes from Warwick to London, via Towcester, also ran through the village. The Oxford Canal, opened in 1790, lay just on the boundary of the village. The parish has been mainly agricultural for hundreds of years, with the ridge and furrow method of farming still evident in places. After the dissolution of Coventry Priory in 1539, the manorship passed through several hands until it was granted to Robert, Lord Spencer, in 1602, who, with succeeding Spencers, greatly influenced the character of the whole area, although the Prior's Marston farms were mainly let off to tenants and not actually farmed by them. The general layout of the fields was finally set by the Enclosure Act of 1758, although with modern farming, a considerable number of hedges have been removed. Earl Spencer is still Lord of the Manor. The village, which became a conservation area in 1972, is an attractive grouping of stone and brick houses, with only minor development occurring until 40 years ago. Since then, as with practically all other villages, infilling has occurred with varying impact on the village scene. High House was built for Earl Spencer's agent, Hillview, by the War Memorial, and was once the workshop of Edward Gardner, a well-known chairman of the Cotswold tradition. Next door, with its tall central chimney, is Westover Farm, once owned by a famous clockmaker called Blenko Churchill, who died in 1764. His clock faces only had one hand. Walk along the network of blue brick paths that run through the village and note how the friendly church and churchyard form part of the village, with its collection of interesting tombstones. There is one for Josiah Key, who died in 1711. Generous local benefactor, who was a locksmith, well, he would be with a surname like Key, to the court of William III and Queen Anne. His house still exists in the village, and a lane is named after him. Nearby you will find the tombstone to Sarah Rainbow, inscribed, "Here lieth one bereaved of life, a sober Christian and a loving wife. Seven sons, to them a mother kind, she lived to bury three, and four were left behind." The oldest part of the church is 13th century. The tower was remodelled in 1720, and extensive rebuilding and renovations occurred in 1863. Records show that a number of stone houses were built around 1650 to 1700, and it is thought that in addition to farming, the local wool trade and the building of Banbury Market and manufacturing helped the prosperity of the village. The Falcon Inn is now a private house, a very old building, and was a calling point for stagecoaches. The Hollybush Inn is also very old, although it has only been a public house since the turn of the 20th century. With a total population of around 500 in 2020, the parish has a modern mix of local town commuters and retired people, with very few people working on the farms. Over 80% of the parish is now divided into just four farms. Several buildings have now been converted into holiday lets, and some houses have become second homes for town dwellers. There are no local industries, and the once brickyard has been developed for housing. The new village hall is a millennium project funded by the local authority, the National Lottery and the villagers. The school, closed in 1994, was reopened as a charity school funded by villagers and other organisations, and it was flourishing with a nursery which opened in 1999.
It's that time of year again and we're all suddenly becoming pancake eaters. This article celebrating them is taken from the National Trust magazine and is read by Margaret.
Fluffy and smothered in syrup, or will only a traditional crepe with its sprinkle of lemon and sugar do for you? More than half of us here in the UK will have pancakes on the 17th of February. But venture beyond the classics and you'll discover a whole world of different flavours to enjoy this pancake day. In the UK, pancakes have long been linked with Shrove Tuesday, the final day before the Christian festival of Lent. Shrove comes from shrive, meaning to confess sins to a priest for absolution. The 40 days of Lent is historically marked a time of prayer and fasting for Christians, when eating dairy and meat was forbidden, along with other pastimes such as games and dancing. Consequently, the days just before, known as Shrovetide, were a time of merriment and indulgence. Shrove Tuesday was the final chance for households to use up all the milk and eggs in the house before Ash Wednesday ushered in the start of Lent. We can't be sure when people first began eating pancakes on Shrove Tuesday, but the tradition is thought to date back to at least the 15th century. Local legend has it that in 1455, a woman from the Buckinghamshire town of Olney heard the shriving bell sounding from the local church as she was making pancakes. In her hurry to make it on time, she raced to the church, still holding her frying pan, thus beginning the tradition of Pancake Day races. It's possible our ancestors ate a very early form of pancake. Starchy residue left on tools suggests Stone Age people used bulrushes and ferns to make a flour, which they mixed with water and baked on hot stones to make a flat cake. Delicious? Perhaps not, but they were surprisingly nutritious, and the discovery changed scientific understanding of the Stone Age diet, previously thought to have been mostly meat-based. By the time of the ancient Greeks, griddle cakes were becoming tastier. Made with olive oil, wheat, flour and water, they were often served with honey. Fast forward another 2,000 years and pancakes have come a long way. They pop up in cuisine all around the world, each with its own twist but linked by the same basic recipe of milk and flour. In South India, the popular street food dosa is made from thin fermented rice pancakes, often stuffed with spiced potatoes, to make masala dosa and served with tangy chutneys. Austria's mid-19th and early 20th century emperor, Kaiser Franz Joseph I, is said to have loved fluffy shredded Kaiserschmarrn pancakes, slightly sweet and often cooked with raisins. They're now a classic Austrian comfort food dessert. And the popular small Russian buckwheat blini has become synonymous with delicacies such as caviar and smoked salmon. Although many of us eat them only once a year, pancakes deserve a place on the menu all year round. They're quick and affordable midweek meal. Try rolling up leftover stews or curries in them and baking in the oven for an easy but comforting evening meal that minimises food waste. For a hearty weekend breakfast, top your pancake of choice with beans, bacon and fried egg. Or you could make them into an elegant lunch with smoked salmon, cream cheese and dill. This February, you'll find pancakes on the menus in many cafes. choose between a host of sweet toppings from classic lemon and sugar and any other of your favourite toppings.
Think of the National Trust, and the image that comes up is of houses of all shapes and sizes. But the Trust also looks after more than 80 historic pubs, inns and brewhouses. Nigel reports.
Beer is probably humankind's oldest alcoholic beverage. Dating back at least 5 millennia, it has been quaffed with enthusiasm in the UK since at least 400 BC. And regulated in the public interest since the 1190s. Through that time, beer has remained a handy ingredient in our pantries too. Whether folded into foamy batters, used to tenderise tough cuts of meat, or to enrich soups, stews and doughs, the mellow and malty combination of hops, barley, water and yeast has proved to be a steadfast companion in our kitchens. Beer was originally seen as healthy. Depending on the occasion, our ancestors would have drunk small beer, probably less than 2% ABV, or table beer, anything between 3 and 7% ABV, saving stronger beer for celebrations. Contrary to the long-standing myth, the poor did drink water, and it was safe to drink from cisterns, wells and springs, while the rich showed off with wine. But for around 2,000 years, beer was the nation's tipple of choice. The National Trust looks after 39 historic pubs and inns and also has a selection of historic brewhouses on estates in its care. The oldest is at Laycock Abbey in Wiltshire, which has rare 16th century fixtures. The high-quality beers of monastic institutions such as the Laycock tend to get our attention, but many medieval housewives would have known how to produce a beer at home. It was close to cooking and vital to the well-being of the household, so it was seen as woman's work. Skillful brewerses, as they were known, not only knew how to produce a range of beers, but how to flavour them deliciously and add herbs to transform them into medicines. For some women, selling beer was also a good way to make money in eras where women's work was heavily restricted. In towns especially, there was a ready market for beer, sold not only by brewers directly, but through alehouses and inns such as the George in Southwark. The 17th century was a time of change for beer. Hops, introduced from Germany in the late Middle Ages, were becoming increasingly popular. They not only added flavour, but they helped to keep the drink fresh for longer. For many years, the word beer signified the brew contained hops. The term ale referred to a beer that lacked them. In 1542, Tudor physician and writer Andrew Ward fulminated against what he saw as a dangerous foreign addition to ale, observing that beer doth make a man fat and inflate the belly. However, a combination of the arrival of hops and the growing urban population helped some enterprising small beer businesses expand into large breweries, which, over the next century, opened tied public houses, pubs, which sold only their products. Despite the skills of female small-scale brewers, these large concerns employed only men. Outside the city, the large breweries were regarded with mild horror, as their beer was not only good quality, so country home owners responded by commissioning their own facilities. This was the heyday of the country house brewerhouse, such as those at Charlecote Park in Warwickshire, Tintersfield in North Somerset, Cork Abbey in Derbyshire, and Lindisfarne in Ceredigion. The brewhouses were often designed by the same architects as the main house. Workers also expected beer as part of their wages. Domestic servants had full board and lodging in addition to their wages. When the family was away, they were provided with beer money to cover the cost of feeding themselves. A manual labourer might burn anything between 4 and 6,000 calories a day, of which a quarter might have come from beer. It also provided calcium, magnesium and several other important trace elements, obviously lacking in the diets of the time. By the 1850s, as tea imported from China and colonial India eclipsed beer as the UK's dominant drink, employers added beer money to wages to compensate those who wanted to continue to buy it. But many servants chose to save their beer money. Beer has long been used as a culinary ingredient too. In the 17th century, you might find it in cordials, a sort of beer custard, or sauces, marinades for curing and flavouring meat. The Georgians adapted for vinegar catsups, relishes and gravies. The Victorians, including Isabella Beaton, added it to stews, such as the beef and vegetable hodgepodge, and for soaking raisins to add to cake, including what was becoming known as Christmas cake. More of the UK population lived in towns, and tide pubs were now the norm. Porter and stout were introduced, along with lighter, crisper beers, mainly from Burton-on-Trent, which were popular across the North Midlands. As beer became cheaper, the number of smaller households brewing their own declined. Public drunkenness was more of a cultural phenomenon by now, and the teetotal movement started to take off in reaction. By the end of the 19th century, only a handful of big houses still brewed their own beer. While a visit to one of the Trust's estate brewhouses or a historic pub may seem like a natural way to engage with Britain's brewing heritage, there are other ways to celebrate our rich history of beer making too.
It's going to be a big year for some. The Coventry Telegraph's Marion McMullen looks at the famous names celebrating milestone birthdays in 2026. Read by Elaine.
Legendary broadcaster Sir David Attenborough turns 100 this year. He joined the BBC in 1952 and later became controller of BBC Two, overseeing the advent of colour TV before he became BBC Director of Programming. The Naturalist has been on our television screens for more than 7 decades, presenting programmes such as Planet Earth and The Blue Planet, and brought out Ocean last year. Born on May the 8th, 1926, he was 26 when he applied for the television training course, following his unsuccessful application for a producer role in 1952. A letter dated July the 22nd, 1952, with a letterhead which reads, "The British Broadcasting Corporation," says, "Dear Mr. Attenborough, thank you for coming to the Central Interviewing Board on Wednesday, July the 9th, 1952. I am now writing to let you know that you were selected for the television training course as a talks producer." Sir David's famous whispering voice captured the imaginations of the nation in 1979, when he was seen mingling and bonding with a family of gorillas in Life on Earth, and its sequel, The Living Planet, in 1984. The following year, he was knighted by the late Queen Elizabeth II, before being awarded a Knight Grand Cross honour in 2022. Sir David said last year, "After living for nearly 100 years on this planet, I now understand the most important place on Earth is not on land, but at sea." The second one, American comedy star Mel Brooks, also turns 100 on June the 28th, and last year declared, "I don't care about immortality, I just try to live." He won an Oscar for his 1967 movie, The Producers, and has also enjoyed success with Young Frankenstein, Blazing Saddles, and Spaceballs. He once pointed out, "Humour is just another defence against the universe." Somebody who turns 90, Alan Alda, who found fame playing Captain Benjamin Franklin, Hawkeye Pierce, in a long-running American comedy, MASH, and he turns 90 on January the 28th. He was born Alfonso Joseph D'Albruzzo, and his father was actor Robert Alda. Alan won Emmy Awards for acting, writing and directing MASH. And British acting star Brian Blessed is also 90 this year, on October the 9th. His booming voice has been heard in I, Claudius, Flash Gordon, and Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace, as the voice of Boss Nass. He is also the oldest person to have reached the geographical North Pole and the magnetic North Pole. Country and Western star Dolly Parton is 80 on January the 19th. She posted on social media last year that "I ain't dead yet," after her sister raised concerns by saying she had been up all night praying for the music singer. Dolly was named a Guinness World Records icon in 2025 for racking up 11 record-breaking titles. They include most consecutive decades with top 10 album entries on the Billboard Country Chart, most studio albums released by a female country singer, and most Grammy nominations for a female country artist. And Vera TV star Brenda Blethyn is 80 on February the 20th. She worked for British Rail before turning to acting and joined the National Theatre Company in 1975. She was nominated for an Oscar for the 1996 movie Secrets and Lies and Little Voice 2 years later. After its 2011 launch, Vera, which followed the almost retired but work-obsessed detective Chief Inspector of Northumberland and City Police, she went on to have 14 series as well as a number of specials. James Bond actor Timothy Dalton will be 80 on March the 21st. He played 007 in the 1980s in The Living Daylights and License to Kill. Dame Joanna Lumley is 80 on May the 1st. She is best known for her roles as Patsy Stone in the BBC sitcom Absolutely Fabulous, Sapphire in ITV supernatural series Sapphire and Steel, and in the new Avengers, the 1970s revamped version of the 1960s ITV spy series The Avengers. She recently appeared in Netflix supernatural series Wednesdays as Grandmama, and in BBC's Amandaland. American singer and actress Cher marks her 80th birthday on May the 20th. She was born Cheryl Arkison and won an Oscar in 1988 for romantic movie Moonstruck, opposite Nicolas Cage. Cher once said, "I haven't a clue why I've lasted so long. There's no reason. There are many people more talented than me. I think it's luck." Rocky and Rambo star Sylvester Stallone turns 80 on July the 6th. The actor, writer and producer was left with slurred speech and paralysis of the lower left side of face from birth complications caused by forceps. He said, "I'm not handsome in the classical sense. The eyes droop, the mouth is crooked, the teeth aren't straight. The voice sounds like a mafioso pallbearer, but somehow it all works." And American filmmaker Steven Spielberg also turns 80 in 2026 on December the 18th and is responsible for hits such as E.T., The Extraterrestrial, Jaws, Schindler's List, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and Saving Private Ryan. The three-time Oscar winner once said, "I dream for a living." And that's the famous faces' birthdays in 2026. I'm sure we will have some famous faces in the Vision Hub community who are also marking landmark birthdays this year. Happy birthday to all of you.
In their latest venture into the world of steam, Dave and Graham Monks visit the Summerfield Light Railway near Bedford.
Graham and I are travelling along on a miniature railway, and it's a fantastic setup, and it's round the Bedford area, that's all I can tell you at the moment, but there's about three railway lines you can go on, and it's really wonderful. I'm actually recording this on a windy, quite cold bank holiday Monday, but it's great fun. That's it, that's a little railway train going past Wrexham and Shropshire Railway. And here's another one going past on a different line. So what's the name of the railway?
It's Summerfield Miniature Railway.
How long has it been
operated by the Bedford Model Engineering Society?
Well, it's a fantastic setup, it really is. Well,
we've been here for about 25 years.
Yeah, that's it. And yeah. There is about three railway lines, isn't there?
Yeah.
It's absolutely fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's a little model railway here. In the middle, there's a little model village here with a church and cottages. Absolutely lovely. What can you see, Graham?
There's a lighthouse.
Over there?
Yeah.
And there's a blue engine going past. The kind of modern, electric train.
The driver's sitting on the Royal Mail carriage, yeah, and they got a Pullman one behind it.
That's fantastic. That's a Pullman carriage. We're travelling behind a Canadian railway engine at the moment. Fantastic. Okay, right, I'm speaking to two gentlemen here. Can you talk about these fascinating engines you've got, please? They're really amazing. You've got a really tiny one there, haven't you, with engines, with the steam coming out of them.
You need to talk to this man here.
Basically, they're small boilers, and they've a maximum of 3 bar litre. So if there was a failure of the boiler, it would just weep out steam and not cause an explosion.
Okay.
So they're very safe. Although if you touch them, you're going to burn your fingers.
Yeah. How small are they? The engines. There's a lovely blue one there.
Yeah, you've got about
smoke coming out.
Yeah, that small one is in the Indian Railway, a mountain railway loco, and that's about the boiler's only about 4 inches long by about 1.5 inches wide.
Yeah.
So they'll run for about, we steam them up for about 30 minutes running, 20 minutes and a half an hour. Then the water runs out, and a lot of them are gas fired, because you can get coal fired, but it's very fiddly putting the very small bits of coal in there.
Yes.
They use proper steam oil to lubricate the cylinders. So it's a full size locomotive in miniature.
Okay, we're going over the railway bridge now, back to the train that we came here on from the original station. This says on one side, there's a sign that says Winterfield Railway, and if you look on the other side, it says Springfield Railway. And that reminds me of the place the Simpsons live, that cartoon program on TV. So yeah, we've been on two railway lines, Springfield and Winterfield, and now we're going back to platform one for Haynes End, which is where we started originally. This, by the way, is Hammer Hill Junction, and it's got two garden gnomes there, at least, big ones anyway, waving at the trains. We're seated in some red carriages now, Summerfield Miniature Railway. Absolutely brilliant. Yeah, we are really enjoying ourselves. Thank you very much indeed.
I'm glad you're enjoying yourself.
We are.
That's the important bit.
It is, isn't it? Thank you.
That's the important bit.
Thank you. I'm doing a little bit.
Same rules on the way up.
Yeah.
Arms and legs in the carriages at all time and no leaning over. And we'll have a safe journey.
We will. Thank you. Well, off we go, back to where the station where we first left. There are three trains at the moment going almost alongside on different tracks. Oh, yeah, on the left-hand side, we have a little mine with a garden gnome and a meerkat. Meerkats are very popular in gardens now, as well as garden gnomes. So, are you enjoying the ride on the miniature railway?
I am certainly enjoying the ride, yes, really, really enjoying it, yes.
Okay, do you live far from here?
I live in Luton.
Luton? Yeah. Well, is this a nice outing for you?
Sorry?
Nice outing for you.
Oh, yes,
as well.
Yes. We come here quite a few times a year, so it's really nice. Really enjoy it.
Absolutely brilliant railway. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Fantastic.
Thank you. Hammer Hill Junction with the garden gnomes by the side of the railway line. Yeah, more garden gnomes by a tree. Okay, so what can you see, Graham?
Buzz Lightyear.
Oh, yeah, there's Buzz Lightyear from Toy Story. And there's some dinosaurs down here. What's that, Graham?
Little miniature train station called Badger's Hole.
Oh, yeah, that's it. Little miniature station, Badger's Holt. And here we are at Haynes End North, and this is where we left the car. And we've arrived at the station. Well, that's all from Summerfield Miniature Railway near Bedford. It's been fantastic, hasn't it, Graham?
Yeah.
Really enjoyed it. Okay, bye!
And that brings us to the end of this week's programme, so it's goodbye from the Outlook team and from me, Peter Walters.